I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source, a radio conversation learning from the internet how to be fast and free all over the globe. This hour, we're celebrating the 400th anniversary year of the Spanish epic Don Quixote, the open source novel, I call it, because it's a patchwork of forms and styles as Cervantes composed it, and it's been a source book ever since for all the world's fiction geniuses, including Dostoevsky and Dickens. Quixote may have been a contemporary inspiration to Shakespeare himself, but in any event, the novel Quixote is a sort of compendium that can be compared with Shakespeare's full range, including Hamlet and Falstaff and Lear. We're talking this hour about the knight and his squire, Sancho Panza, in the proto-novel that many say is the greatest of all novels, Don Quixote. Please join the conversation at 877-673-6767 or brandish your sword on our website, radioopensource.org. Our Quixotista in the studio is James Ifland, professor of Spanish literature at Boston University. Welcome, Jim Ifland. Count the ways that we should be getting to know Don Quixote.
Well, I'll start off with the proper way. En un lugar de la Mancha, de cuyo nombre no quiero acordarme, no ha mucho tiempo que vivía un hidalgo de los de lanza en astillero, adarga antigua, rocín flaco y galgo corredor.
Brilliant.
In a village in La Mancha, the name of which I cannot quite recall, there lived not long ago one of those country gentlemen or hidalgos who keep a lance in a rack, an ancient leather shield, a scrawny hack, and a greyhound for coursing. Now, the reason I've started my remarks this way tonight is because, strangely enough, despite the fame of Don Quixote, very few people actually have read it, even in the Spanish-speaking world.
I love your Spanish, but I want to brag a little bit. I've read every word of 1,000 pages of Edith Grossman's translation. Excellent. Nothing like your sound, though. Go ahead.
Excellent. Now, as I say, even though people haven't read it, they know it. They know the work in a very odd way. The world is saturated with imagery having to do with Don Quixote and Sancho. We have the paintings, we have prints, we have cartoons, we have movies, we have ballets.
Songs, the impossible
right,
dream.
What I've called the iconosphere that surrounds the figures of Don Quixote and Sancho. So unlike, for example, Lear and Hamlet, whom if you, say, flash them up on a screen somewhere in Times Square, nobody would probably be able to recognize them. If you do that in the case of Don Quixote and Sancho, practically everyone will know who they are, even though they've not read the book. And in some cases, in many parts of the Spanish-speaking world, people who are only marginally literate will recognize those figures. And you almost have to go into the spheres of commerce or religion to find something like that. You'd have to. It's only comparable to, say, Mickey Mouse or Ronald McDonald or Christ in terms of the immediate recognizability. Now, that would seem to be an advantage in a certain way, but in many ways it's a bane because they're surrounded by all of these references to these two figures, they don't bother to.
This is important as a way of just sort of clearing the space. The book is not what we think it is. It is not a comic book. It's not very funny either. It was a huge surprise to me, I got to say. But you continue.
No, well, everybody used to think it was funny, and I certainly do find it quite amusing, and my students do as well. But what I was going to say is we have to start by putting aside all of that sort of hardwired, sort of preconceived set of notions that we have about the work and actually sit down and try to read it from stem to stern. Now, as you pointed out, it's got about 1,000 pages, and some people say, oh, my God, it's so long. But you have 10-year-olds plowing through Harry Potter now, you know, 500, 600-page novels at age 10, and the notion that a grown adult can get through the 1,000 pages is a little bit discouraging to me.
Let me jump ahead.
Go ahead.
This is a writer's book. Every big writer calls this number one in a certain way. Is it also a reader's book? Can it be?
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to bring up next. Once you start reading it, this work becomes what I would call a kind of playground for the mind, a kind of jungle gym for the mind, almost a kind of a Rubik's Cube. It's better if you read it more than once. Each time that you go through the text, you will find something different. I've taught this work dozens of times. Each time I read the text, I come up with a different angle. I see the whole work in a different light. And what is so wonderful, also, if you do run across some of those people who have read the book, and there are many who have, a wonderful dialogue begins between you and those other readers. It's almost like meeting another member of the Red Sox Nation, in the sense that you have people who have this thing down, chapter and verse, and we have these wonderful free-for-alls in which each of us tries to convince the others about the validity of our points.
I like the idea of a Rubik's Cube, and it is continually different, continually reshaping itself, mm-hmm. as it did under his hand. I mean, he writes about writing it. He writes about rewriting it. He writes about people plagiarizing
right.
it and competing editions.
Right.
So he's writing to them, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the reader's experience is similar. But deal with the sort of the fundamental thing that Nabokov maybe wrote most clearly, that sort of shape up, kids. This is not comedy. The guy is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cruel, violent series of very dark episodes. It's not what you thought it was.
Well, that's actually a very modern reading of the work. I've done a lot of studying, along with many of my colleagues, trying to reconstruct what would have been the reception of the work back in the 17th century. And all of that slapstick physical violence in the text was laughed at heartily by people for
tossing Sancho Panza in a blanket is one thing, but how many teeth get knocked out of poor Quixote's head?
Indeed, indeed. Although you will notice that begins to sort of decline a little bit after the first 20 chapters. And if you get to part two, I mean, there's lots of cruelty as well in part two. And in that sense, Nabokov is in fact right. To a certain degree, seeing how, quote-unquote, sane society treats Don Quixote, we may come up with an image of that society which is not entirely favorable. I mean, the Duke and the Duchess, I mean, these are rich brats in many ways who make fun of Don Quixote often in very, very cruel ways. I think that whether it's a cruel book, I'm not so sure. I think we can say that it is, on a certain level, an infinitely sad book. But at the same time, it is, in my opinion at least, an infinitely funny book. And that, for me, is the key to the magic of the Quixote. How
yes.
something that is so funny can also be so terribly, terribly sad. I mean,
I was going to say, yeah. Nabokov, of course, came to that point, too. Mm-hmm. And he eventually concludes that this character not only gets bigger in the book, he gets mm-hmm. bigger in history in 400 years of people reading him. He says at the end of his amazing lectures mm-hmm. on Quixote, we do not laugh at him any longer. His blazon is pity. His banner is beauty. He stands for everything that is gentle, forlorn, pure, unselfish, and gallant.
Mm-hmm.
The parody has become a paragon.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing humbling of him, his brilliant self in front of this.
And very, very obviously, very acute, very perceptive set of remarks. Now, the interesting thing is that it would have been impossible to say something like that before the Romantics, the German and English Romantics, essentially refashion Don Quixote. Starting in the late 18th century, early 19th century, outside of Spain, people began to see this character who had been perceived primarily as a comic character, they began to see a kind of a pathos there, a kind of transcendence, a kind of nobility. His madness was a noble madness, and I mean, you have people like, say, Turgenev saying that humanity can be divided up between those, the Don Quixotes on one hand and the Hamlets on the other. In other words, these are the two fundamental types of human beings.
Meaning what?
Hamlet being the sort of the introspective, neurotic person who falls into passivity because of all the problems that he's having, as opposed to Don Quixote, who launches forth and tries to set, let's say, an extrovert who tries to set the world aright by sort of noble activity and sort of military exercise in the world.
Is America Quixote, perhaps?
Well, we've had some interesting discussions about that. In fact, Diana, who I think is listening, had a very nice talk about this in Amherst a few
She's
weeks ago.
She's going to join us in a moment, and I'm going to ask her and you continue mm-hmm. through this hour to remind us gringos that mm-hmm. this is the work of another language, another society, and we way, way mm-hmm. underappreciate it. But in a minute mm-hmm. before the break here, why, above all, do people think this? So many people put this number one mm-hmm. in the world's novels.
I think your comment that this is a writer's novel is right on target. This book not only created, of course, two quote unquote immortal characters, and I'll even take off the quotation marks if you like. It also marked the way for the modern novel. We can talk about what that term means, and people will discuss it for hours and hours and on end. But Cervantes essentially generated a type of writing that opened the doors for the great realist novels.
I want to open the door to callers. Okay. 877-673-6767 is our phone. We're talking this hour about Don Quixote at 400.
Hi, this is Brendan. I am the Open Source Blogger-in-Chief. Every show on Open Source is open for public discussion before, after, and during the broadcast. Listeners suggest shows, suggest guests, share their reading lists, and then tell us what to ask. You can call this citizen journalism, or you can call us lazy, but you can find us at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, talking this hour about the novel Don Quixote on its 400th birthday year. Join the conversation at 877-673-6767. Diana de Armas Wilson joins us from Denver, eminent author on English literature and Renaissance studies, author specifically of Cervantes, the novel, and the New World. Where's to begin, Diana, on this great book?
Where do I begin?
Please.
Yes. I very much enjoyed what Jim Ifflin said about the jungle gym for the mind, but I was more taken by his reading of the book as terribly sad. That may be a new reading, and it may be that people in other generations laughed until the Romantics. But I think that knowing a little about Cervantes, And the fact that he belonged to the last generation of Imperial Spain, that's after the triumphs of New World conquests, such as Cortes, Pizarro, etc., and Don Quixote refers to Cortes, I think thinking in terms of this book as written by actually a maimed veteran of the 16th century wars, particularly of Lepanto, and also very knowledgeable about the fall of Spain's 16th century empire. It was a superpower under the Habsburgs, and the empire stretched from Naples to the Philippines, and and Cervantes worked for the empire. He was actually a tax collector just before the Armada, had temporary jobs. The main point I want to make is the empire was really unraveling quite precipitously when he was writing. Spain was going through global wars, plagues, inflation, bankruptcies.
Queen Elizabeth had just defeated the Spanish Armada, 15 years before this book was published?
Yes, exactly, 1588. And it was 2 years after that that Cervantes tried to emigrate to the New World, and he was refused. And after that, he had a series of, you know, quite terrible jobs. In between, of course, writing Don Quixote. He landed up in prison because of a shortfall in tax collecting, not his fault.
This is fascinating. So this is a war veteran's book about an empire, or at least in the context of an empire in decline. So what? Do you take it as a commentary on empire?
Well, I do think it's a really profound exploration of human nature during an age of, I guess, imperial crisis. I agree with both of you that it is not a funny book, although I have laughed at it in the past, less so as I get older. And I do think it is more pathos than punchline, as you said, Chris. Above all, I think we have to distinguish between Don Quixote, the character, and Don Quixote, the novel, because Don Quixote is really a lunatic, and his role is he embodies what I see as both the glory and the price, the wages of Spanish imperialism, of misplaced heroics. And above all, we have to remember how he got there. I mean, he went mad because he was addicted to reading these trashy novels of the day, the romances of chivalry, many of them based on Charlemagne and his 12 peers, all those runaway bestsellers of the Renaissance.
Sitcoms.
And these are the novels that fried his brains. And so I see him as a victim of a kind of chivalric spin. And the book mentions 7 or 8 times that its only purpose is this demolition project to, you know, to trash the novels of chivalry. I see this as, you know, there are many ways to read Don Quixote, of course, but I think that I have been reading it this way, in this kind of imperial reading, and it may be because I've paid more attention to the Christian versus Muslim struggle, which is really the backdrop of Don Quixote. And
Speak to that point as briefly as we can. There's a lot of talk in the book about conversos, Jews who've been made Christians, refugees coming back, attachment to the land, uncertainty about citizenship, all this sort of thing. What is the point of that 100 years or so after the Moors and the Jews were driven out of Spain?
Yeah, well, the Jews had been driven out of Spain in around 1492, but the Moriscos, which are the Muslims who were, you know, supposedly converts, would not be driven out until 1609 between the two parts of Don Quixote. But, I mean, apart from this history, what we often don't appreciate is that there was a Christian-Muslim struggle in Spain, an 800-year struggle from 711 to 1492. And, you know, we hear so much talk of caliphates from the White House these days. There was a lot of talk in Cervantes's day about this also. And as you say, the book is drenched in Islamic culture, and I think the main thing we have to remember is that Don Quixote identifies very much with the Christians, but his entire story, and that's parts one and two, is narrated by a very endearing Muslim called, he's an Arab historian, Cide Hamete. Yes. And Cervantes says he's only the stepfather. So that is a kind of puppetry of an amazing order.
Do you want to comment on Jim Iflin's point that there's a fruitful tension here between Hamlet and Quixote? I mean, Hamlet is sort of Don Rumsfeld's idea of old Europe. Quixote is this kind of, intrepid leap right in. Defy the consequences. Who cares about the victims? Reckless yank. Is there anything there, Deanna?
That dualism between... Well, I think that Hamlet and Don Quixote, I would rather bring them together rather than make them, differ so. Because think of it, they both kind of suffer from what I'd call a surfeit of altruism. They both have this kind of naive compulsion to set things right. In Hamlet's case, it's more of a personal in, life within the castle. In Don Quixote's case, it's really global. I mean, he specializes in liberation, as we know from, of course, the great moment of liberation is the galley slaves, which we all remember, and they stone him for it. But there are so many liberations in Don Quixote, the farm boy, the Basque matron.
Yeah, he liberates a farm boy who's getting whooped to death by his master. And And as soon as he finishes his noble job, of course, the master starts whopping him again. And hundreds of pages later, the boy comes back and says, "What the hell was that about? You didn't do me any good at all." I mean, not only is this man genuinely crazy, he inflicts terrible hardship on people. I mean, he is Mr. Unintended Consequences.
That's so true. And the farm boy actually later will curse him for it. And he's very ashamed to hear that. I mean, he kind of skulks, Don Quixote does. But, I mean, he's forever liberating people. The major liberation is in book two, Master Peter's Puppet Show, where he tries to liberate a bunch of Christian puppets from the Moors. And, of course, he ends up slicing all of the puppets to bits. So I see that as a kind of reality check for would-be liberators. And I also see that Don Quixote is a kind of European novel that can maybe wake us up to the role of Islam in history and in fiction. I think we've had a monumental incuriosity about it. About, as Jim said, people don't read Don Quixote.
Deanna De Armas Wilson, stand by. We're talking about Don Quixote, the novel, on its 400th anniversary. 877-673-6767 is the phone. Mike is calling from Boston. Hello, Mike. Mike, are you there? We lost Mike. We liberated you, Mike, and then you attacked us. Sorry about that. Jim Iflin.
No, I think he's on.
Mike, do I hear you? No, I don't think so. That's what we get. Jim Iflin, it's your turn.
Well, just to pick up one of the points that Deanna was making, we get back to that fundamental issue. Do you judge the person by the intentions or by the results of the execution of those intentions? And the entire novel, as Deanna has pointed out so well, is full of Don Quixote going out and trying to do good with disastrous results. So ultimately, how do we judge this character? The other thing that I wanted to highlight or to follow up on with respect to what Deanna said was the whole Islamic connection. At this time, in the early 17th century, there was a large population of Muslim origin in Spain. It was perceived of as a fifth column. There were rumors that they were collaborating with the Turks. The Turks had a rather large fleet that would attack the Spanish coast. You had the Muslim pirates in the north coast of Africa that would attack. And these people were constantly under suspicion of collaboration. And sure enough, 4 years after the publication of Part 1 of Don Quixote, Spain went through a process of ethnic cleansing. The entire remaining Morisco population was thrown into exile. It didn't matter whether they were Christian or not. The fact that they were identified as Muslims was enough to get them expelled. That, in many ways, I think, syncretizes very interestingly with the moment that we're living in this country, because there's a similar, I would say, psychosis about things Islamic.
The book is, as Harold Bloom says, a mirror held up not to nature but to us and to these moments. But, Deanna, I wish you would walk us back through the Spanish readings of this book right from the beginning. And how does this book, get a... Mean different things to the Spanish language part of the world.
Jim mentioned that people laughed, and of course that's what we know from reception theory, that Spaniards originally found it very comic. I think that by 1898, of course you have the whole Romantic movement. By 1898, when the Spanish-American War, so-called, Spain loses her empire, we have figures such as Unamuno, who sees Don Quixote as a kind of national Bible, and as a Spanish, the hero as a Spanish Christ figure. So we've really moved from a very hard reading, the comic readings, to soft readings, and I think.
Can you explain that briefly? I mean, how Quixote becomes a kind of suffering Jesus in the modern world?
Yeah, that's hard for me to see because I know that he suffers a lot. But also, he kind of asks for a lot of his problems. I mean, so that is Unamuno's reading. It is not my reading, necessarily. I guess, anyway, that soft, hard business, I feel that the correct position might be somewhere in between. And I do know, however, that by the end or the middle of the 20th century, someone like Jorge Luis Borges was seeing Don Quixote as an occasion for patriotic toasts. In other words, it had moved quite away from the heavy Christian readings. That's where we go, and I don't think I've done justice to the Spanish peoples because, of course, every Spaniard I know has a different reading of Don Quixote.
Stand by for callers. Mike is back. 877-673-6767 is our phone. Mike, welcome back.
Well, hi there, Chris. Sorry about that. I went into the tunnel just as I was about to go on.
Sounds like Quixote.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm glad your guest mentioned Borges, because I was going to call and say, I'm not a Quixote. I haven't read it since I was in probably college, and I'm driving in a car, so I'm a bit at a loss. But one of the great short story reading experiences of my life was reading Borges, as I think it's Pierre Maynard, author of The Quixote, where he posits a writer who sets a task to himself of writing Don Quixote without having read it verbatim and succeeds, at least in part. And then Borges turns that into a tale about creative reading, because he'll quote a passage from Quixote and say, see, this is so-and-so, and then he quotes the exact same two paragraphs, assuming that they were written in the 20th century by Pierre Maynard, and proceeds to tell how much richer and deeper the meaning is because of it existing in the 20th century. And to me, it's the power of what readers bring to books and how something can be created that lasts forever.
Mike, that's brilliant. Is that a way of saying that this was a kind of pre-modern and postmodern novel all at the same time?
Well, I don't know. I just think, for Borges, of course, it's the Spanish novel, so it's everything to him. But I think an English writer could have decided that they set up a protagonist who decides he's going to write Hamlet without having read it. by immersing themselves so much in the mind of Shakespeare that they're able to do that, which is what he has Pierre Maynard do to Cervantes.
Mike, I'm so glad you brought it up. Jim Ifland, Take us home on the Borges point.
Well, Borges, of course, thought that Cervantes, along with Francisco de Quevedo, were the only two Spanish authors worth reading. But Borges clearly was a very careful reader of Cervantes. And what is amazing about Cervantes is that he, among other things, is the fact that he not only puts the lays the groundwork for the modern novelist of the more realistic type, but he also lays the groundwork for the reaction against that, the sort of the experimental, avant-garde, self-reflexive types of writing that we say find in Borges. Let us not forget that in Don Quixote's library, there's a copy of La Galatea, which was Cervantes's first novel. So Don Quixote has read a novel written by his creator. The priest who is going through the library is a friend of Cervantes.
Can I ask a crazy question? Unquestionably, Cervantes is a complete genius, but did he know what he was doing? Or was he just winging?
I think he was winging in the way a genius wings it. We're talking about a guy who is 57 years old. He's for all intents and purposes a failure. He's not made it doing anything that he's done. He's not been able to cash in at all. And there he is. He begins to write this novel, and he's got absolutely nothing to lose. And I think that he just had an enormously wonderful time writing this thing. And he was not there thinking, I think I will write a work which will enter the canon and will be part of the core curriculum at many universities around
the world. But loved it right away, no?
People loved it, and what is amazing about it is that you had people dressing up as Don Quixote and Sancho in the carnivals immediately after its publication. You had Don Quixote and Sancho appearing in carnivals in Peru, on the other side of the world, in 1607. 2 years, this is before email, before the web. Within 2 years, people were dressing up like Don Quixote and Sancho. Which brings us to a point that many have made, which is that these characters actually probably come out of the popular festive.
I want to take back what I asked about, you know, did he know what he was doing? Clearly, it was beyond anything he could have planned or conceived. We're talking about Don Quixote, and when we come back after the break, I want to talk about, finally, what it means, who this character is, what quixotic means in his world and ours. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, talking this hour about the Cervantes masterpiece of 400 years ago and forever, Don Quixote. And I put it out there, what does it tell you that Fidel Castro, it was the first thing that Fidel Castro published when the revolution took over in Cuba, and President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela gave away 1 million copies of Don Quixote this year on the anniversary. Our phone is 877-673-6767. We're talking from now to the end about what it means. Bud Parr joins us. He's a literary blogger responsible for Chekhov's Mistress on the page and the anniversary Quixote blog called 400 Windmills. Busy year for you, Bud Parr. What is it all about in the end? And what did your kind of readers, general readers, make of this masterpiece?
Well, I think for me, it kind of starts at the end, because the first time I read the book, I had a very difficult time getting through it, and I put it down not even halfway through, or not quite to the first part. I couldn't get through all of the gross out humor and everything. And then when I started this website and we all started to discuss it on a regular basis and write about it and kind of dig in a little bit, and then through that got through the whole book. There was so much more there in the second half. It's even a big question to me how, if the second half never appeared, would it be the masterpiece that it is today? Yet they were published, 10 years apart.
It wouldn't have that meta masterpiece feel about it.
Right. So I find that kind of amazing. And it really does kind of, these characters really, you live with them by the end of the book, because they're so human and we're kind of like them in a way.
So who in the end is this man? And what does he tell us about, his world and ours?
Well, he believes in his world, right? I mean, maybe that's why, you mentioned Chavez. And, a guy like that, he wants to right the wrongs in the world. And, but the world is against him, and he has to really believe in his version of reality against all odds, against, the whole world. The world powers telling him that he's wrong, and so there's that idea of believing in your reality. I think that
he believes in himself, no question, but everybody around him, the barber, his maid, his niece, they want to get him home, get him into bed, get him out of harm's way, and get us out of his harm's
way. But they kind of believe in it too. I mean, they go so far as to play act and get involved in it. It seems like they as much as they're just trying to deceive him, they kind of become a part of that same world that he is.
Deanna, what do you think? What about this guy? You wouldn't want him living next door, I don't think. Or would you?
Oh, I'm not sure. Actually, he's also very lovable. He's kind of a sane madman is a phrase, an oxymoron, but it's a phrase used continuously about him. And, of course, there are these wonderful lucid moments where Don Quixote is so intelligent. I've been very interested in that word quixotic, which you mentioned a little earlier, because it seems to be trotted out, so frequently in our media these days. And I'm wondering, if all of you think that this happens when heroic values are on the wane. I know that Christopher on his webpage defined it as the word quixotic, as serving a whole multitude of meanings. You could be valiant, vain, visionary, insane, and many others. But there's one meaning that I'd like to kind of reconsider, have us all reconsider, and that's that kind of imitative copycat quality of Don Quixote, because he lives and he copes with the world in imitation of literary or media models, and these are obsolete heroic models. So they're scripted, they're profoundly unoriginal. And finally, I've thought of Don Quixote as a person who converts windmills into giants so he can then attack them. He liberates people who will then turn on him, and then he repeats this behavior, staying the course. I guess my question is, why do I still care for him? Well, I don't know how to answer that.
What you said, obsolete, I think, is kind of interesting, because at some point I looked up the definition of quixotic in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it says striving with lofty enthusiasm for visionary ideals.
Yes.
Well, lofty enthusiasm is right, but visionary ideals, I mean, I kind of see Quixote as a conservative. He wanted to return back to a better time and go back to his way. He talks at some point about how well he lived at some point in time, and he wants to, go back to that.
He actually wants to go back.
Jim Lifland. Ifland.
He actually wants to go back to the Golden Age. In Chapter 11 and Part 1, when he sits down with the goatherds, he refers to that wonderful time in which, for example, people didn't have to make too much effort to be able to feed themselves. There was no private property.
Yes,
women were able to go around without suffering violence. And he says that because that world is no longer around, this requires his intervention as a knight errant. Later on in chapter 20, he actually says that he wants to restore that world. So actually, Don Quixote at one point says that he wants to restore a form of, if I may, of primitive communism on a certain level.
Have we said enough about the Chavez-Castro identification with this figure?
Could I?
Sure.
That adjective cuts all sorts of ways. I'm sure that many of you, when you ran for mayor way back when, probably said that was a quixotic gesture on your part. And it was probably a compliment on a certain level. You may or may not want to answer that.
Oh, no. But, of course, if anybody says to you, oh, that you're being, that's quixotic, that means you're going to lose. It's just a waste of time.
If I may add to that.
Please.
Do you both remember John Kerry's presidential defeat? The New Yorker spoke of something like the quixotic quality of his gallant but doomed struggles. In other words, gallant but doomed. There's always that kind of doomed quality in the struggle of the quixotic. Or do you disagree?
Although I mean, the thing about Don Quixote, of course, most people tend to forget. Because they, or maybe it's because they don't get to page 1,000.
Yeah.
They don't know that he in fact renounces
his
dream. I'm sorry
if
I'm giving away the end to many people, but he does renounce his dream, and most my students hate that.
It's a downer. It's a terrible downer.
It's a terrible downer. They cannot accept the fact that he gives in. So.
And then he dies.
And then he dies. Of course, he dies.
That's life, kid.
But my point is that when quixotic is used positively, and the figure of Don Quixote appears all over the place. For example, in Latin America, associated with different, let's say, liberation movements, and what they see positive in that in Don Quixote and in the notion of being Quixotes, is this notion that you know, there is a lot of evil in the world. There are a lot of wrongs to be righted, and you keep going no matter what.
There are Quixotistas in Indiana, too. Mike is on the phone from Lafayette, Indiana.
Hi. Well, my first, I did read the book 30 years ago in graduate school, and I was thinking about the buddy. This may be the archetype of the buddy that we see in Mark Twain and all the way up to Thelma and Louise, but the contemporary analog for Don and Sancho seems to me is George Bush and Cheney.
Amen.
Or how about Blair? Don Quixote.
You can have him too.
Bush and Blair.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So where do we go with that, Mike?
Well, I think we go with the. Righting the wrongs of the world, and in the meantime, making a mess of everything.
But isn't that because some liberations are inept? But in Don Quixote's case, I mean, the conception is usually very noble, and that's what readers have to struggle with, that he is such a noble and good person, and we love him.
And usually, Don Quixote is not out to liberate people who own a lot of oil. In other words, in that sense, I would like to defend Don Quixote and Sancho. It's an interesting comparison, the Bush Blair or the Bush Cheney. But quite frankly, I don't think we can ascribe to those two the same kind of the same ethical access as we can to. Don Quixote and
such. Absolutely.
Mike in Indiana, your comment was right on the money. 877-673-6767 is our phone. Kel is calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Hi, guys.
Welcome, Kel.
You know, it's funny. I'm reading this book now. I started about a month ago, and I'm reading the new Edith Grossman translation, which is just hysterical. It's very, very funny, and I'm a doctor, and I have some training in psychiatry. And the thing that's interesting to me, taking it very literally, is Don Quixote was mad. They say this many, many times in the
right.
book.
Amen.
And he was obviously hallucinating most right. of the time, delusional.
Didn't you want to diagnose him, Kel? Is this Alzheimer's?
No, no.
Would a pill help? I mean,
no.
The problem?
He was a manic depressive.
Hmm.
We know that that Freud? We do know that Freud was reading Don Quixote when he was inventing psychoanalysis.
He learned Spanish precisely to be able to read Don Quixote in the original.
Interesting.
But what does it mean if you're mad and you realize at the same time that you're mad that you are mad?
There are many times
in the book where he kind of looks back at what he's doing, or there's one where he says, I imagine this or that, and he's, did I say imagine? In the sense that, okay, I kind of know what's going on here. I'm not, I believe you believe, but it's not really so that I'm mad.
I'm only about a third of the way through, but...
We've interrupted you 8 times already, Kel. We're not spoiling your pleasure in the book, I hope.
Oh, not at all. The thing with the barber basin...
Yes,
that he thinks
the
is
helmet.
The helmet of somebody or another.
Mambrino.
And throughout, ever since that object has been in the book, he insists that this is some magical helmet, in spite of everybody telling him no, it's just a barber's basin. So I don't think he has much insight into reality throughout this story.
Well, that's very very interesting set of comments, and some scholars think that Cervantes actually based. Let's say the whole image of Don Quixote's madness on an early, let's say, pioneering book of psychiatry written by a Spaniard back in the 16th century, and so there's actually a lot of connections between Don Quixote's madness and the description of madness in that particular.
Can I
just say one more thing? The other thing that's fascinating and hysterical to me is Sancho Panza's. Enabling of Don Quixote.
Yes.
And every other page, he's trying to figure out the angle, how he can use Don Quixote's madness to advance his own aims.
Right.
And it's so funny.
Can I ask you all a question on this sort of sanity, insanity? In the Barbara Grossman, in the Edith Grossman translation on page 732, the author says that Quixote spoke nonsense only with regard to chivalry, and in other conversations he demonstrated a clear and confident understanding, so that his actions constantly belied his judgment, and his judgment belied his actions, but that his judgment was good. What is the essential judgment here that was sane? What is the quality of his mind? What is, in a sense, the lesson of Quixote for us?
May I add that only in regard to chivalry, I'm so glad you mentioned that. That doesn't come up until much later in part two, alas. But it is true that Don Quixote, when he goes mad, actually Susan Sontag said that it was not so much madness as we're reading a great epic of addiction, that Don Quixote is addicted to these kind of books, and much as we see many other addictions today to the internet or whatever, but he just, that's where, that's where he's kind of mentally, I don't want to call it insane, because Don Quixote, Cervantes continuously plays with the sane-insane dichotomy, and at some point makes it very clear that some of the other 570 characters are also insane.
Deanna, but what's the core of the sane judgment that the author is endorsing there?
I don't quite understand.
Well, he's sort of apologizing for his loony moments, his bad highs, his delusions, but he's saying his judgment in an action, this is there's something really strong here and good and sound. What is
it? Yes. That's... very good. It's what we're left with, I think, that is so sound. Don Quixote is, very intelligent about so many things. except for that one. He just, that's the one he limps on, that one thing. I would say there's also this element of goodness, that Sancho at the end weeps for him because of his master's goodness. I think we, maybe that's what we are left with.
Exactly. And so, can I say quickly, for listeners who want to be readers, is the Edith Grossman translation, which is readily available now, worth buying? Is that the good one or not?
That's the one we read in our group that we we wrote about on the web. And
I've heard very, very many good things about it. I've thumbed through it, and I think it's obviously a solid translation. I actually don't mind the John Rutherford translation available through Penguin, but I, again,
maybe we should model ourselves on Freud here. Learn Spanish. I also want to throw it out that maybe, you know, in the end, and sort of what is the sound judgment at the core of this character, maybe we have to come back to Nabokov. He is everything, says Nabokov, that is gentle, forlorn, pure, unselfish, and gallant.
I think that we have to remember that in the last chapter, we find out something that we didn't know about him until that point, chapter 74 of part 2. That is that before becoming Don Quixote, he was known by his neighbors as Alonso Quijano el Bueno, the good. In other words, that he had there was a fundamental goodness about him that characterized him prior to his going mad. The madness, of course, was the door through which he had to go to translate that intrinsic goodness into a kind of activist goodness, with mixed results, as we've been pointing out tonight. But the question is, I mean, he was just sitting there on the farm doing nothing for 50 years until that point.
Then he got mad and it got interesting. Let's read it again. Thank you so much, all of you. James Ifland here in Boston, Deanna DeArmas Wilson in Denver, Bud Parr in Brooklyn. You can keep talking about Quixote. You can help us work on next year's shows at Radio Open Source, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Thanks also to David Carger. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon, also known as Sancho Panza. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.